The Western Hemisphere Department of the IMF. Thank you. We have Jose Juan Ruiz. He is the chief economist of the IDB. Ernesto Talbe, the director of Brookings Ceres. And as I said, we have Muni Jensen with us. And the title of this forum is Latin America Prepared to Resist the Turbulent Global Economy. Of the world economy, and I'd like to give the floor to Ernesto Talbe so he can answer this question. Ernesto, thank you very much, Juan Carlos, for that introduction. Well, midst 2012, when the crisis was at its peak in Europe, Latin America also experienced a decline. China was cooling off. Commodities were going back to the prices of 2004. The interest rates were going up. And many economies were cooling off in a significant way. And so Argentina and Venezuela are going to come up in this conversation because they are not typical. And we're also going to talk about Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Peru, and Mexico. We can say that in similar circumstances in the past, we would already be seeing reserves fleeing, debt crisis, crisis with regard to currency, perhaps coup d'etats. And so much has changed since then. So that with the international liquidity levels that we have, with the capitalized private banking and stable political systems, we think that the problems will come through other traditional kinds of mechanisms on the monetary side, for example. In this regard, the governments are going to have to balance and adjust as they can to the new situation and take measures. This means in monetary terms, they're going to see a depreciation of currency in order to be competitive and also to deal with any recession pressures and also maintain the stability of prices. And those that have low growth rates can afford not to raise interest rates or even lower them and also allow inflation to go above targets without committing or without compromising their credibility. However, Brazil cannot do that. They don't have that luxury. They're going to have to raise interest rates to try to keep their credit rating high, but also they need to deal with these recessive pressures. Now, we have other challenges to deal with. We need to be, or governments need to balance the adjustments to new circumstances and maintain credibility, credit worthiness, and also the capacity to pay the debt. Those that are beginning this process with low deficits and limited debt, like Peru, well, they have a great deal of leeway to, over time, have fiscal consolidation without making abrupt kinds of adjustments, which would bring pressure of recession. But Brazil, that has high deficit, high debt, is going to be obliged to make immediate adjustments in order to shore up its credibility and also its public finance credit worthiness. To some, we have these external circumstances, and so all countries are going to have to go through surgery. It's going to be more or less, but we're going to have to go through surgery. We need a surgeon that can be effective and can be precise. And the issue is that what we're seeing with this cooling off, a stagnation of salaries and increase in unemployment, is that the popularity of presidents in exercise and popularity of governments have declined in almost all Latin American countries. But the good news is the following. in most of the countries, this has not translated into a lack of governance or paralysis. But in Brazil, unfortunately, the largest country in the region, the decline in popularity of the president and the approval ratings of the government has gone hand in hand with the Petrobras scandal. And we do have a paralysis of governance, and that means that there's no surgeon heading this up in a moment when they needed very deep measures. If we are going to sum it up, those from the TPP are going to have to go through painful adjustments, but not traumatic in our opinion. Brazil is in a very complex process without leeway with regard to fiscal and monetary policy and great deal of political fragility and a lack of investment. And in my opinion, this could lead very quickly or in some months to having Brazil go to the IMF in order to have an orderly adjustment, although they have a high volume of reserves still. But we can debate this later. We need to talk about the nuances with regard to the multilateral organizations. The scenario that I see, Robert, is that the IMF is going to be going around our region with some programs which are going to be needed in some countries. And the development banks, I think they're going to play a very key role to be able to facilitate what we like to call intelligent austerity in those countries that have solid macroeconomic fundamentals but are going to have difficulty in accessing credit. And the multilateral organization, the IDB, CAF, World Bank can play an important role. They have access to resources which are available in the world, and they can take them to Latin America and the emerging countries to finance profitable projects, both economically and socially profitable. It's interesting, and I'd like to conclude by summing up what I said. This world seems to be a world of more traditional problems. The issues are on the fiscal and monetary side, unemployment, some institutional political challenges, of course, and also the multilateral side, the IMF playing its traditional role of instituting programs with countries that need it, supervising macroeconomic fundamentals in those countries that don't need financing, and the development banks financing projects, and also looking at the nuances. This is for Augusto. You said that Augusto is divided between those who are, let's say, in the U.S. group and in the China group. Do you think that all countries will be able to meet these challenges? Thank you very much for allowing me to be here and to speak with my friends and colleagues. As Ernesto said, we have been adjusting to external factors for 4 years, and these external conditions have to do with what's happening in China. And if we had been here 15 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about China, because what was happening in China had no importance for Latin American economies, and the world has changed. And now China is very important, especially for South America. That means that the current external circumstances, well, South America, it has to absorb an external shock that is greater than in North America. Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean are following the U.S. recovery. And we have then South America that is going through an experience where they are actually experiencing this decline of China. So we have this bifurcation in the world. And the world has two groups. The U.S. helping to spur growth through consumption, and then we have China. And I think the biggest risk is that these two cycles, the one in the U.S. and China, go off path, and China does worse than we think, and that could bring the U.S. down and the rest of the world down if there was deacceleration. We hope that that doesn't happen, but that's what concerns me. Now, the region is adapting to these new conditions, these new external conditions, and what I'd like to emphasize with regard to what Ernesto has said, well, it's different to do macroeconomy in Latin America than in the U.S. In the U.S., well, every 80 years there's a large crisis, but during the other 80 years, well, the U.S. grows 2% year over year. So you just need to soften the cycle so that there is stable growth. But in Latin America, we have to do that. And what is even more complicated, the trends change. So now we're facing a changing trend. So the counter-cyclical policies that we have available is limited. So we need to have a new balance in the macroeconomy that's less favorable, and that's difficult. And that is a task that is much more complicated than just managing the cycles. We're going in a transition phase. And, of course, this is much more difficult than we thought. It's not causing financial crises like we saw in the 90s or the 80s. It is has to do with difficulties with regard to labor markets and price adjustments. And so these are new processes for the region. The region is learning through this process, through variables and spheres of the macroeconomic policy that are quite different from what they faced during times of financial or banking crisis. And in this process, there are some countries that are suffering more than others, depending on the magnitude of the adjustment, also the availability of instruments, in particular countries that can have flexible exchange rates, and they have an advantage versus, for example, Ecuador that cannot change its exchange rate to absorb this. So in my opinion, the adjustment process to external conditions has not finished. We have not reached bottom. When you look at the macro situation of Latin America, we believe that the only country that has touched bottom is Chile. However, there are more complicated policy questions in Chile, which is stopping it from going back up. But I think there's a lot to be done, and a lot's going to happen. I think this year we've had almost zero growth, and there's a lot to absorb. And this is true in the labor market. In the past, the labor market in Latin America always was accompanied by great inflation. Usually, if there were crises, there was great inflation. This ate away at salaries, real salaries, and we are not in the Latin America of the past. The inflation is low, and we're not so worried about that. So we have a more complicated labor market, and we're seeing what's happening. Employment's going down. The quality of employment is changing. The workers that were working in large companies are going into smaller companies with less salary. Those who had low salaries are going into their own businesses. And there's an adjustment process in the growth of salaries. And I think that that's a very important question with regard to social policy, whether this adjustment of the labor market will be regressive. And remember that Latin America in the last 15 years was one of the few regions in the world where we had a reduction in inequality of income, and that we're happy about that. And now we're at the low point in the cycle. The question is whether there will be greater inequality in income. We think yes, but it's going to be different. In the labor market, there is more unemployment. there is an increase in unemployment, as I said, and then we see young people who have least amount of education and who are men. They're the ones that are going into the labor markets. That's affecting the income of poorer families. And so we think that part of these social tensions will come from trying to absorb these labor market adjustments. And that means that we might lose out on some of the gains as far as income equality is concerned. Now, I have a question for Mr. Rengkar for the IMF. What you call these counter-cyclical policies, before we came in, you said that you wanted me to ask you about these kinds of policies. And I told you not everyone here is an economist, and perhaps in simple words or simple terms you can explain this to us. Well, the interesting thing is what we are experiencing in the global economy is quite different from what we saw in 2008-2009. With the global financial crisis, everyone implemented what we call counter-cyclical policies, policies to designed to foster growth when they were facing this shock. In Latin America, that meant a greater public spending, a less tax income, and also lower interest rates and depreciation of currencies. Now the region is facing another kind of shock. It's an ongoing shock. The exchange rates, the prices of commodities are lower, and this is something that is sustained over time. So this means that the region should not necessarily implement counter-cyclical policies because there's not enough of leeway to do so. On the tax side, the fiscal side, the fiscal deficit, it's a weaker position than before. Public debt is higher as compared to 2008, and the level of public spending is higher, and it's more permanent. And those that export raw materials or commodities have less tax base or fiscal income. So there's less leeway for fiscal adjustments to spur growth. Now, with regard to monetary and exchange rate policies, Chile, Mexico, Brazil, their currency have depreciated on the exchange rate markets. That's good. And in Chile and Colombia, for example, the depreciation of the currency has an effect on inflation. They need to raise interest rates to actually control inflation or expectations of inflation. But the most important point is that this is an ongoing shock. And so we have the potential growth at midterm is less than some years ago. So we have to emphasize the fact that we need structural reforms to diversify exports and help their economies. Many reforms could take place. For example, the rule of law, intellectual property rights, more competition in markets. So the private sector needs to look for new sources of growth. And the region is still not open, really, very much to international trade. And perhaps we need more international cooperation to have trade amongst Latin American countries. I think the important point is that this is a more permanent situation globally, and we need structural reforms in order to foster growth in the medium term.
Juan Luis, just a few years ago, Luis Alberto Moreno, the president of the IDB, published a book on the decade of Latin America. There was a lot of excitement about this. Nobody was expecting this hole we're in, but things have changed. Some of the statistics published in early October in Lima after their meetings, where they talked about the region's economy this week, they estimated that Venezuela will grow by 10%, Brazil 3%, Ecuador 0.6%. And the economies of Asia Pacific are better, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile. So my question to you is, are there reasons then to be pessimistic, or do you think we can still be slightly positive? Thank you very much. Thank you to Ernesto and Robert and to Channel N24 for inviting me. I think one of the advantages of being the last one to speak is that I can simply confirm the ideas that my president had about this. In recent meetings, we have not heard the term that I thought the one that was going to guide the conversation, which is the lost opportunity in Latin America. I don't think that's the case. What we're talking about here is something quite different. What we're talking about is how Latin America is once again asking the systematic question that it asks all the time of how it's going to address development, taking into account how the region has changed because of the opportunities that Latin America did take advantage of in this past decade. I think the best way to look at the opportunities that were made the most of is to look at three different figures, put them into like a trinity, a triangle, as it were. So we have 0%, then we have 66%, and we have 17%. Those three figures correspond to different vertices. So that is the economy, 0% growth, 66% is the number of Latin Americans who themselves state that they are part of the middle class, and 17% is the number of countries in the region and that in their constitutions have ongoing re-elections for president. These have a lot to do with each other. The opportunities that were taken advantage of in Latin America are in the social and political pillar. 30 years ago, you were talking about, Augusto was talking about China 15 years ago, but if 30 years ago somebody had asked what the political outlook for Latin America would be three decades later, it would have been very unlikely that they would say that this is a continent that 30 years after the democratic wave, the third democratic wave in the world would be consolidated. The answer that Latin Americans have said that they might be more or less pleased and that there are certain weaknesses still in their economies, but democracy has been consolidated effectively in the region. The citizens of Latin America still have unfinished business, and that is, we have democracy, but we're not modern states that are able to offer the public goods and services that will help to make the leap toward development and the institutional capacity necessary to take this on. So the opportunity that was taken advantage of was democracy. And so we could say that the unfinished business is the modern state and how to overhaul the system of elites and to ensure that institutions are able to extend democracy to the majority of citizens. And then the other side, we have 66% of society, and 66% consider themselves to be part of the middle class. And this is the outcome of 15 straight years of sustained growth. This 66% has a great deal to do with how we're going to face the future based on something Augusto brought up. Much of the mythology as to how this middle class came to be has to do with the idea of profits, the prices of commodities and the profits therefrom have been spread amongst the population, and this has had a major impact towards improving conditions. this technology transfer has to do with 1% of GDP. And the truth is, the middle classes and the World Bank did an exhaustive study about this. This growth of the middle class comes from job creation, and this is what has led to the creation of the middle class and improvements in reducing inequality, income inequality, because wages of unskilled laborers have jumped higher than those of skilled laborers. So Latin America has something to thank the state for, but a great deal of the reason behind the fact that they're part of the middle class, but it's vulnerable, but it's because the labor market is growing. So what is happening in these two different pillars? Well, and these two bases of the triangle depends on what happens at the point of the triangle. It has to do with the political system. And this is what Robert from the IMF and Ernesto were saying. There's the possibility of implementing counter-cyclical measures. Can the government do that? And how are we going to adjust to new conditions? This interaction is what's going to define the future in Latin America. Without growth, volatility is going to be much greater, and growth, we know how it appears. It's a medium and long-term reforms, adjustments, as Ernesto was talking about, and the ability to have integration processes underway in the region. Many experiments have been done trying to combine political, social, and economic aspects. In the 80s, they decided to leave the middle class and impact on society to one side, and first, the major macroeconomic balances had to be struck because and they had to legitimize these governments, and then looking at equity. This is the history of Latin America in the 80s and 90s. I don't think that's possible nowadays. I don't think we can talk about readjusting the region's economies at the cost of moving backwards in processes to improve income and wealth distribution and have inclusive economies. Equity is no longer under discussion in Latin America alone. It's something global, and you can't implement policies the way they were implemented in the 80s and 90s. This is not going to go anywhere socially or politically, because society is going to have something to say about it. As we've seen in some examples, well, okay, if I forget about the macro economy and I'm just going to look at social policies, and I'll just forget about macro balances, and I'll just keep kicking the can down the road as long as I can. Sure, you can do that for a little time, but the macro indicators are going to impose the need to pay attention to them. So what we're discussing here is the capacity governments have to delay adjustments. I mean, something important to think about here is if Latin America has learned anything from the past, it's the capacity power to dilute these adjustments. It depends on the institutions that have been created. It is not a coincidence that countries with strong currencies don't have inflationary pressures. And these countries that have good reputations and who have anchored the expectations to this. So it's not a coincidence that these countries that are talking about fiscal adjustments and that they can do them over 3 or 4 years, it's not a coincidence that this has not led to an fiscal runs or exchange runs that we've seen in the past. They are now fiscal rules, transparent and well-known processes that are open to the public. So what are the constraints to continue to make intelligent adjustments? And the major item that's pending in the region in terms of growth and development is long-term reforms and the building of institutional capacity that will allow for intelligent and more focused adjustments, looking at the discussions on government spending and institutions to be able to respond to shocks is going to be far more important than the actual size of the shock or the mistrust that investors have. And that's the major discussion on the table. I think the region has made strides in that sense, and so I'm not pessimistic. Okay, well, I wanted to talk about the 66% that Jose Juan talked about, the middle class. This is it has to do with jobs and their lack of satisfaction. Is this something good for democracy, that they're questioning the sitting governments? Or is this something that's a threat in that populist leaders might come to the fore? This has happened in Europe, and they don't have much political weight, but they're saying a lot. Well, this is certainly a challenge, Muni. It's a very significant challenge for the region, as Jose Juan was saying, in the adjustments and how they're prioritizing job creation, looking at young people who have low levels of education, but looking to create jobs for them. And middle classes are being threatened by recessive processes and adjustments in these social processes. I think we have to dissuade this idea of having populist proposals, and the way to do this is that the governments and the established parties will have to internalize these policies and ensure that they're taking into account in their adjustment policies the need to expand and make opportunities more equal. This has to do with education and job training. If those things are not done and no resources are devoted to that, I believe, unfortunately, that there will be unrest in society and opposition to an entire process of adjustments, and it can undermine some of the achievements that were so hard won. I wanted to ask Mr. De La Torre and Remek and Jose Juan as well, what Latin American countries are doing well economically and what are not. I'm looking at the lack of satisfaction of middle classes with their governments. And Latino Barometer, they were saying that in 2009, approval ratings of sitting governments, of 17 governments, was 60%. Right now, it's 47%. So this is a very significant drop. So it gives the impression that Latin American citizens are bored with the current governments, the current administration. So what countries are doing well? I would like to talk about democracy before I get to your question, because I think it's key. It's true, as Jose Juan was saying, that the region is a region whose democracy is more well-established now, but there are some serious challenges in terms of democracy, and I'd like to share what I think. There are a group of countries in the region where the quality of democracy has deteriorated. The checks and balances have been done away with for all intents and purposes. The balance of power has been weakened. And just the fact that they hold elections doesn't mean that there's operational representative democracy. This is very significant. There are three or four countries in the region whose democracies have deteriorated. Now, there are some countries with stronger democracies, and they have to have political debate, which is precisely what creates this lack of satisfaction. If we look at Chile or Brazil, democracy there has to process like a new social arrangement wherein there have to be more credible institutions. The relationship between the state and the market is discussed in a significant way there, and this is a test of the democracy. Entering into discussions and reaching new agreements. I think there's going to be democracy is going to be rather hard hit. For social progress to continue, there must be jobs. But the jobs from here into the future cannot be based on increased consumption as it was in the last decade. In last decade, growth was based on high levels of consumption. Now it has to be job creation with more moderate consumption that must be based on greater investments, more exports, and investment. It's not going to be easy to create jobs with this new economic dynamic. Think about now, there are countries that have devalued a great deal in recent years, but their exports aren't necessarily growing. And if their exports don't grow, where are the jobs going to come from? But they do sometimes because we have a restricted capacity to create new exporting businesses. Our economies need to have a more competitive exchange rate, and it has to be favorably. But things aren't going so great in the world right now, and they're not sending enough products. But this is extremely important. And the last point on democracy that is of great concern to me is that the region has lost its ability to do self-monitoring in terms of democracy. What they've done is they've seen situations where we've seen a deterioration of democracy. Let's think about Venezuela. The U.S. government, has anyone in the U.S. government criticized Venezuela? No, the presidents of the region have remained silent. So there's this silence that does not help to strengthen democratic institutions in the region. Well, I'll be a little bit more specific than Augusto was. Well, at the end, he was specific. Okay, well, at the end of his remarks, he was. I think countries that are doing well economically are Mexico, Chile, Colombia, and Peru. Yes, I think the challenges are slightly different. Argentina is very complicated nowadays. The upcoming elections, and it looks at the speed of the adjustments that are going to have to be implemented in 2016. It's not a question of whether adjustments need to be made, it's when. Brazil is complicated, but the Petrobras scandal has its positives and negatives. What's good is that they're tackling a major corruption scandal head on, and this means that 10 years from now it's going to be a much stronger country. Venezuela obviously is very complicated situation. There's no good management there in any way, shape, or form. Ecuador also has problems because of its dollarization. The government recognizes the need to implement adjustments, but it has no option to devalue its currency. Jose Juan? And having heard what Augusto was saying, and I was first thinking about Latin America, but then the chip switched over to Europe, and I thought, okay, let me put myself in Europe and consider democracy. They have the same concerns there, the same concerns that Augusto was noting in Latin America. Those exist in European countries as well. That's where you have these moral values of European countries, but now we're seeing what's happening with the migration crisis and who's raising their hand to help. So at the end of the day, Augusto's points, which are extremely important, bring to bear what I was saying at the beginning, that Latin American democracy is not unique anymore. It faces the same problems that any democracy faces, which is what your conclusion was at the end. And at the end of the day, this is a complicated world. We don't know how to grow. We've lost sight a little bit of the context that Augusto brought up in China, where there's stagnation, but that doesn't mean that there's no ability for growth. I remember when in Latin America, it isn't so different from the rest of the world. We were always the outliers in the global economy, and we were simply showcasing what was happening. But now we face the same problems that other countries do. And this is one of the results of globalization, and all governments in the world are worried about the ninis and the technology revolution for the disabled, and all governments of the world are worried about how cohesive their societies are and how they're growing, even though it's true that there are weaknesses and checks and balances in countries. So we're not so different, and we were able to make the most of the past 15 years, not to mention some hopeful situations, but it does seem that some countries are moving towards more democratic systems and that are friendlier to freedoms, like is the case of Cuba and the possible repercussions that that will have on the region. And the second item that's important, who's doing well, who's doing poorly? If we look at this exclusively from the standpoint of policy outcomes, I don't think that's the right way to proceed. What countries have truly put the medium term on their agendas and institution building and strengthening on the agenda? These countries continue to rely on commodities where external cycles explain 80% of our economic cycles. This has been the truth for the past 100 years. And so how are we going to tackle these challenges so that we're consistently on top of the trend? We have to have more diversified economies and institutions that are better able to absorb or help in the case of shocks. That's the medium and long term in the region. With all difficulties and all the gradual movement, I do see progress in these countries that we've noted. It's not a coincidence that Peru, Colombia, Chile, and Mexico have central banks with very good reputations. They have fiscal rules in place. They have checks and balances and economic governance. Obviously, there's still much more to be done. But with this institutional building, I think it might help us to at least put to one side the enormous volatility that is sometimes a result of policies implemented, but it's because we are so vulnerable to the international economic conditions. And, okay, which countries make you lose sleep, which make you feel good? Well, Uruguay. So which economies make us lose sleep? I already discussed it, and has a lot to do with the question. And those that make me see the silver lining, the light at the end of the tunnel, and somebody said, and I don't remember who said that we've forgotten a few things in terms of development, but that there's not one single experience in the history of development, not a single one, that has not resulted from very significant entrance or penetration into the international economy. More foreign direct investment, more trade, etc. So there's been great prosperity in the world as a result of trade. And the freest and broadest trade possible. So what I'm seeing here are very important things based on what we're seeing in the new geographies of international negotiations. We have the TPP, which is basically the U.S. And Asia, Japan, and some other smaller players, and then the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the United States and Europe. So that's the next generation of trade agreements that go beyond the World Trade Organization and they're designed to address issues that are not easily resolved among 66 countries. For example, government procurement, intellectual property, leveling the playing field within countries so that other countries can participate. These are very complex issues that will be done amongst a few countries, and then the rest of us will join in. So the Pacific Alliance, they themselves have this 2.0 TPP. And it has to do with what's happening in the global economy. Three of them are already part of the TPP. So I see these countries working very aggressively to be part of the 21st century's integration. Now, if I'm going to be a pessimist and say, well, what's happening on the Atlantic side, as you were saying before the meeting when we were talking about Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, and here is where I see another light at the end of the tunnel, even though there are so many problems, and that is the private sector in Brazil, even in light of what I've said right now, has realized that the path they're taking is going to more absolute and total isolation. And therefore, old protectionist measures and reflexes don't work, and the private sector in Brazil is fighting for greater international penetration. So I think the political dynamic is going to catch up with the needs of the private sector. And then in the next 25 years, we're going to see a much more aggressively integrated Latin America in the world. And this is going to help the continent to grow more. Well, what about the productive sector? Are they going to be able to build this free trade road, as it were? When they create these structures, these continental highways, and they continue to export the same products to the same exact markets, so there need to be parallel efforts by the governments to have a diversity in exports, because that's what will sustain growth. Yes, to a certain degree, what you've said, we have to look at this figures. If you look at the exports in countries now and the structure of exports compared to 25 years ago, even if it's just in the case of China, it's changed, either the markets or the products. So the export diversification in the continent should be greater. That's likely true. And that's likely where we could, right now, in times of low growth, start to think about some public policy actions that could be taken or reject them, because it's not suitable to talk about public policies for economic adjustment. They don't enjoy consensus, or because they're external factors like the exchange rates that have an impact on this. Likely, right now, what we should do is look for growth within the region, and because world economic growth is lower right now. And look at the reactions in the real exchange rates. There are businesses that you couldn't have had in 2009, 2010, 2011, because the competitiveness of the manufacturing sector was affected by real exchange rates. This is likely where we're going to see the most possibility for short-term growth. Bringing together these two things. First, greater regional integration, and secondly, productive activities that are a little bit more diversified and than what we've seen in the past 20 years when we're talking about the dependence on commodities. But now commodity prices are low. So this is the time when there's probably the likelihood that you could have public policies be implemented that in the past had no chance.
Well, we could think about Brazil, which is traditionally a protectionist country, and they produce airplanes, and Colombia, which is an open country, continues to produce coffee. There is the aeronautics industry in Mexico, which actually has a turnover of 30% more than Brazil. I don't think Colombia has failed because it doesn't produce planes. Rather, is with regard to car manufacturing, etc. If we look at the sophistication of airplanes are impressive because of their size. But if you look at the degree of sophistication, it's not even 7 or 8% of the products that the country produces and exports and require sophistication for production. And you look at countries that have economies based on commodities, New Zealand, Australia, where the agricultural base is very large, where they produce milk, meat, which is not very sophisticated, but they have gone up the chain, let's say. They now export 60-65% of their package, and it's very sophisticated. So it's not some activities are going to substitute others. And the development process is that you continue to do what you've always done, but you broaden things so you can become more sophisticated. But what we need are two things, institutions, and this also requires a labor force that is highly qualified, highly skilled, and we don't have that in Latin America. If we had those two things, we had also integration in markets that would allow us to take advantage of them. We could, end up having a very good educational system we could avoid ending up like Cuba that has a well-educated labor force, but everyone is underemployed. So I'd like to let Augusto comment. I like the fact that we're talking about international trade integration because it seems to me this is an area that has not been exploited in the region to spur growth. And this is complicated, as we have said. There are different agendas that need to be implemented. In my opinion, I think we need to make a psychological jump. In the past, Latin America had integration on one side that was regional and other that was international, and we had steps to have different trade agreements within the region, thinking that that was a better bet than having international integration. But the Chileans did go for international integration, but it's not a choice here, not one or the other. When we look at Asia, Southeast Asia, we have integration in the region and internationally. And with more regional integration, they have more effective exports to be integrated in the world. So this is a virtuous cycle to have both kinds of integration. In Latin America, we haven't known how to take advantage of this cycle that is virtuous. We need both kinds of integration, and we could grow much more if we could integrate in the world and amongst ourselves. And amongst ourselves, the more we integrate, the more we integrate in the world. So we have some minutes for a few questions from our audience, maybe three questions. And please say your name before your question. And a question, please, not a comment or editorial opinion. For the IMF representative, you mentioned that the IMF can go back to its traditional role in Latin America. Do you agree with that? What countries would be the ones where the IMF would be intervening, except for Brazil? And perhaps Latin America also has bad memories of past IMF interventions. Well, it's a very difficult, of course, to predict which countries are going to ask for financing from the fund. Brazil has not asked for anything from the fund. I don't know if they're going to. And there are countries that are in bad shape, but they're perhaps not the ones who are going to ask for help from the fund. And I'm always surprised how long countries can last out. Thank you. I'm not going to answer the question because I can't. It's impossible, absolutely impossible, to predict who's going to ask for the fund to intervene. President Reagan once said, he said, instead of answering the questions, I'm going to actually talk about why I can't answer them. Please state your name and who the question is for. I'm Adrian Peralta. I work for Trust Network. I have a question for Ernesto. The conversation has been about Mexico and South America, but what do you think the outlook is for the Northern Triangle, in other words, Central America, which is suffering violence from drug trafficking and crime? Well, we're going to take questions. Well, let's have a few questions, and then we'll answer all of them at once. Thank you very much. Now, with regard to Mooney's concern about the sophistication or diversification of exports and the comment with regard to the sophistication of the export package, maybe one of the panelists could comment about the future. Well, what recommendations you would make to work on the sophistication of the export package given the new circumstances? Another question? Thank you. Anand Rosenberg? I think this is for Ernesto, but could be for anyone. You said that the problems have to do with integration in markets and the democratic system, but that means behind that there is a capitalist sector that wants to invest and also take on risks. And so what I am concerned about is that we're going to go back to our old ways. The private sector sometimes doesn't do what it's supposed to be doing. And here we have another question. The lady back here, yes. Good morning. Isabel Arizante. I'm a collaborator of Caracas Chronicles. And my question has to do with the labor market. We have been glad because there has been growth in the middle class. But how much is that from the informal market? And now we're facing economic turbulence. How much of that middle class is going to face vulnerabilities and perhaps fall out of the middle class? Another question? Thank you. Pablo Pardo. I'm from El Mundo. For Mr. Werner from the fund, in the short term, everyone was expecting the increase in interest rates in the U.S. and its impact on Latin America. Now, this is being put off time and again, but prices are dropping and there's deflation, and so interest rates are growing in reality. Can this have the same impact on Latin America, the same impact that the rise in interest rates would have, and can this cause turbulence? Who would like to go first? Now I'm Mexican, says the gentleman. With regard to the Fed's impact, I don't think we're seeing deflation in Latin America, or no signs of it, or in the United States. For Latin America, the issue is whether the for Latin America, it's whether the Fed will be increasing interest rates and when, and it depends on the country. For example, in Mexico, if the federal fund rate goes up and the U.S. economy recovers, this is good for Mexico because there is more demand for Mexican exports that are sold in the United States, and that is more important than the impact of the rise in interest rates. Now, for Latin American countries where the links to the U.S. are not as strong, the impact would be greater. So the rise in the rates by the Fed will have an impact on those countries. It will be slow down growth a bit. But I don't see signs of deflation in any country in the region. As a matter of fact, some countries have the highest inflation rates in the world, so I don't think that's a problem in our region. Mr. Talvi, I'm just going to answer one question because I think Jose Juan can speak to the question about Central America. And so I think Jose Juan can take that one on. Look, I just want to reflect on the idea of productive sophistication. It turns out we have Nicolas Herrera here, who's the vice president of our board and also president of the foundation Impulso, which is the first private secular school that is free in the most vulnerable neighborhood in Montevideo. And what was done was a revolution in management. I don't have time to go into it, but it's a different kind of management than what has occurred in traditional education structures that take children from very poor backgrounds who come out of elementary school, those who usually drop out, those who usually perhaps have problems with the law, and they are taken into an environment where, in addition to having great academic demands, it's also an environment where they are nurtured, which perhaps does not happen in their families, where they are told, welcome to life, which is what a friend of mine always says, right? I can assure you that when you see that firsthand and you see the results and outcomes that you can achieve with young people who supposedly have no chance in life, that's when you really have hope. Those young people are going to have a future. They're going to think that maybe they have a future. They thought that they were going to drop out of school when they started, and now they think they're going to have a future. And with this, I'll conclude. The best predictor of upward mobility in studies that have been done here in the United States is to have a four-year college degree. Thus, I think in a continent where 50% of young people, in keeping with international testing, cannot be employed by the formal economy because they do not have the minimum skills to work in a know-how economy, This is a society which, in its foundations, cannot imagine that this is where sophisticated products can be manufactured or made, because you need skilled labor. So that is the challenge the region is facing for equality, equality of opportunities, to fight against social exclusion. What we need is quality education, especially directed toward the vulnerable segments. And Jose Juan, I want to tell you something. Before, we thought we had to grow to include people. This logic that I explain means we need to include people to then grow. I'm very optimistic with regard to trade, but less optimistic that some reforms can go forward. But there are examples. There are some points of light out there that we're seeing, and hopefully government will emulate these models. And the other question? With regard to Central America, I think that there is an historical injustice. When we talk about Central America, we talk about Latin America, and we think that the drop in commodities is bad for the entire region. That's not the case for the Caribbean and Central America. It's quite the contrary. Central America imports commodities as well as the Caribbean. They're net importers of commodities. And yes, for them, it's a positive shock. This lower commodity prices, and secondly, a very high growth in the U.S., and they can actually benefit from that. You have to remember that remittances from immigrants are 12 to 18% of GDP, and any changes in migration laws could have a positive effect. Where are the big problems? You mentioned them. The weaknesses of the state, a state that actually has a monopoly over force and the use of force. And we see a citizen reaction, however, to this. I think that there have been changes in small countries, not just large countries. I think that countries that are facing pressing problems, they are reacting to the problems of safety and security, and middle classes are reacting. What is the possibility of short-term improvement? Well, it's a bit depressing, but Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister of the UK, said to impose the rule of law, well, the first 500 years are always the most difficult to do so. And I think it's a gradual process. But there is a change, I think, that has happened, a qualitative one. In 5 minutes, we'll start our second panel. Thank you, Augusto, Jose Juan Ruiz, Ernesto Talvi, and also our friend Robert Rennick.
I think we can begin. Once again, thank you to the Brookings Institution for this panel in El País. I'm Juan Carlos Iragorre, the director of Club de Prensa NTN24. I wanted to thank all of you for being here. And I'd like to thank our panelists. This is the first time the Brookings Institution has held a forum exclusively in Spanish. But first, I wanted to introduce Paula Lugones, a correspondent for Clarín from Argentina. We also have Claudia Trevisan, a correspondent from O Estado de Sao Paulo, one of the most important newspapers in Brazil. We have Mark Bassett, the U.S. correspondent for El País here in Washington. We also have Jose Jaime Hernandez from El Universal de México. He's here in the middle. He is one of the best-known correspondents from Mexico. We also have Jose Manuel Restrepo, besides being a columnist from El Espectador in Colombia and who appears on many radio programs and opinion programs, he is also the dean of the Universidad del Rosario. This is a university that's been around for more than 350 years. It's one of the best known in Colombia. Thank you for being here. I wanted to begin with Paula Lugones. I'm going to try to make this a briefer panel so that we have more time for questions. Beginning with Paula, we're going to have presidential elections in Argentina on Sunday. This is at least the first round. The runoff would be November 22nd. And the candidates, Daniel Scioli, who is from the Front for Victory, and then we have Mauricio Macri, the main opposition candidate, and he's also related to Boca Junior. And then we have Sergio Massa, who's third in the polls. So I wanted to ask you, Paula, how you see the political and economic outlook in Argentina right before the election and the end of the Kirchner era. Thank you, Juan Carlos. It's very difficult in 5 minutes to summarize the complex reality of both the economy and the political situation in Argentina. I'll try. Fortunately, the previous panel gave us a complex and excellent description about the general issues affecting the region and what are the particular challenges. Argentina is facing all of those challenges and issues, but there are some specific characteristics that I'd like to point out now so that you know what the next president of Argentina is going to have to face. First, statistics. Nobody knows really what's going on in Argentina. It seems like it's from another planet. In the past 10 years, it's been a decade where the government's been tampering with statistics and manipulating them, so we don't know what inflation levels are in the country. The unofficial estimates are 25%, which is the highest, one of the highest in the world. Or the government says about 11%, which is much higher than what they admitted it to being just a year ago. And then there's the matter of growth. If we consider GDP, or they're not looking at GDP, they don't think it's that necessary, or they manipulate the statistics, at least internally. And then if we look at IMF measurements, external measurements, that Argentina has not been growing in the past 2 or 3 years. They've had negative growth. And that next year, they're predicting just 0.5 point growth. So the stagnant economy is going to be a major challenge for the next candidate or president. Another very specific situation to Argentina is about the exchange rate. The government says that this is something that was invented by the candidates or the media. But this is a measure that Kirchner took in 2011 to prevent capital flight. And what it did was create serious distortions, not just for businesses, exporters, importers, but for regular citizens where they don't know where they can purchase dollars so that they can save or take a vacation. There are serious problems for exports. There are major restrictions on imports because of different bureaucracies. It's very difficult. And for the exporter import of inputs with the dollars. And so this has created a black market or a parallel market where there's a dollar, a parallel dollar that is worth twice what the official exchange rate is. If we add these to all the complexities being faced in the region and the drastic situation in Brazil with years of recession and a serious devaluation of the real, this is clearly going to have an impact on Argentina because Brazil is its main is Argentina's main market for our exports. Something else is fiscal spending. There's been a huge amount of spending in recent years, especially this year in an election year. As the previous panel said, this is a reality, generally speaking, in Latin America, but government spending in our countries is huge. It's approximately 5% of GDP this year. And something else that's very of great interest in the U.S. is the matter of holdouts. You know that this there's been a case in the courts in New York about this. Argentina says that once these scavenger funds are these holdouts, but they say that Argentina doesn't want to pay. Argentina is in selective default or partial default or whatever you want to call it. Even the government of Argentina says they have no idea what that's about. They're not in default. They are intending to pay. So there are external pressures. Nobody wants to lend money to a country in default. And there are so many complexities if you want to invest. And even to take money out, companies' profits, it's very difficult to take them out of Argentina. It's a very complex process. So it's a very complex situation. Everything is kind of frozen in time. Nobody's making decisions. The regular citizen who wants to take a vacation is waiting to see what will happen to the dollar in the next administration. So we have elections this coming Sunday. As Juan Carlos said, there are three candidates, the ones who have the greatest chance of winning. We don't know if there will have to be a runoff. That will be known on Sunday. But there is consensus, at least amongst the teams of the three candidates, as to what the most significant issues are in the short term. And what is Scioli saying? Who's the one who's number one in the polls right now, who could very likely be the next president? If he wins in the first round, if there's a runoff, we'll see. But what's he saying about this currency exchange control? He was saying, okay, if he's the candidate, this is the official party, which was blessed reluctantly by Kirchner. She doesn't like him too much, but officially he is the government's preferred candidate. So he says, well, I don't know about this currency exchange control. It might exist for some time. We know that there are lags, but they probably won't be lifted at the very beginning, but they'll raise the rate of the dollar, especially for this exchange lag. And Massa says, no, on my first day in office, and will take away all barriers to imports, exports, and everything will be done freely. So the big question is, how will the dollar fluctuate? What is the exchange lag that exists in Argentina? So that's what nobody knows right now. What about the holdouts? What is each candidate saying about the holdouts? Massa and Macri are saying that we have to come here to the U.S., go to New York, and negotiate immediately with these funds. This is what is required in international finance. Argentina needs external financing quickly to make the corrections and adjustments necessary. It needs fresh money. So they're saying in their ambiguous policy said, yes, in this particular case, it's a matter that has to be resolved. We have to have a goal. But they're saying, okay, we're not going to do this on the backs of the citizens. We'll do it in a dignified way. So this may be something that the Kirchner followers are pleased about, but the future Jorge Manuel Urtubey, the future foreign minister, who traveled to New York to talk to investors and who said publicly that we have to negotiate with the holdouts now. We need a fresh injection of funds in Argentina so that we can make the drastic adjustments. We need foreign investment and loans. Without them, we will not be able to deal with the matter of holdouts and get a fresh injection of funds. So in summary, and we'll be able to talk about this in more detail later, if you will. But people are already talking about the post-Kirchner era. And no matter who wins, and we believe that there will be changes. There's going to be a surge, as we talked about before. And this is going to be a major operation. Is it going to be a major operation, drastic operation, or is it going to be one that's gradual? There are regional and municipal elections coming up in Colombia on Sunday. So I wanted to ask José Manuel Restrepo what's in play. Are the mayorships in Bogota were 8 million of the 40 million Colombians live there, and in recent polls we've seen Enrique Peñalosa and Rafael Pardo, who's from another party, and Claro López. You have written extensively about this. So now the peace process is underway. And the government of Juan Manuel Santos and his team and the team from the FARC, and Santos and the chief of the FARC made an announcement about an agreement as to how the members, not just of the FARC, but other armed groups operating outside the law will appear before the justice system. And then in the third week of March, that's the deadline for the signing of a definitive agreement. But Colombians are continuously wondering, what benefits will peace have for the economy? Because the time when there was the most investment in Colombia was during Uribe's administration, and this was to fight terrorism. So it was greatly beneficial for Colombia. I mean, can we say that or not? Well, first, I'd like to thank Brookings and Juan Carlos for this invitation. I'm pleased to be at this event and to see that this is in Spanish, and it's the first one that was ever done in this institution entirely in Spanish. As I'm from academia, I can allow myself the luxury of telling you a story where 15 years ago I was with students in my macroeconomics class, and I said, what are you going to do in the future? And 85% of those young people wanted to leave the country. And not to do a master's degree or get their PhD. They wanted to leave the country because they saw no viable options in the country or the possibility of a country with any sort of future. So if I ask that question now to a similar group of students, most of them believe in the country. They believe there's hope. And what happened on September 23rd what the government signed, and looking at the 23rd of March, went a long way toward building up society in the countries. And we shouldn't forget a clear reality. This is a situation that has existed for more than 50 years. My generation has never lived in conditions of peace. We have had to live with terrorism, with violence, in such a way that the possibility of what can be built from here onto the future is huge for the country. And what will happen on March 23rd is key, and not just that day, but months thereafter when they're going to put down their weapons. This is going to be extremely important for future generations of Colombians. Of course, Colombia is part of this global economic turbulence. We saw that this is a model and example of those countries that have effective macroeconomic policies in place. And in the case of this economic turbulence, what happens there is what happens to some. It's kind of like when you're at sea and then it's low tide. So everyone knows who is wearing a bathing suit and who is not. And I believe that Colombia is wearing the bathing suit. And you can see this through different realities. It's because there have been social policies. It's been very strong. The unemployment rate has dropped significantly, more than 40%. Absolute and relative poverty has dropped by approximately 50%. Informality has also dropped dramatically. So there's better quality jobs. And this building, the middle class, has more than doubled in the country. So there is a significant social platform and human capital, which is what's necessary for building toward the future. We've seen this through a direct foreign investment in the country. We've almost broken the international record on increases in foreign direct investment in the country. This means that in following macroeconomic rules, people believe that the nation has the ability to withstand the crisis that is currently underway. But what happens then? We have to ask the question, how are we going to prepare ourselves for the coming years? The matter of peace, many studies have been conducted in the country, and it says the impact on growth in the country could be between 0.4 and 2.5% additional. There have been more than 20 different studies where the estimates are more or less those. There are different realities, however. The impact won't necessarily be immediate. This is a reality we have to bear in mind. The second situation is the following. It won't be equal nationwide. There are some regions that will benefit more. Those that have historically been in conflict may benefit more than others. Then there will be an impact. The markets have almost ruled out this phenomenon already. And so there will be an economic impact. That's the only way to understand this foreign direct investment and its increase in the country. And lastly, there's an impact in terms of cost. Peace isn't free. You can't just sign a peace agreement and immediately live in a different nation. There are going to be costs for reintegration, not just for those who were involved in the combat, but for those individuals who lived in conflict zones in the country, all of the forced displacement. What about the cost for victims? This also has a significant impact on the economy. With or without an agreement, there's going to be a process of rural reconstruction. These areas are significant and they're relatively large. And so if we're going to look to the future of agro-industry, we're going to have to work with the public goods in these areas. And lastly, we have the matter of infrastructure and pensions. If we look at estimates, and again, there are about 15, 16 studies about this, it would be between 1.5% of GDP annually. That's what it's going to cost us nationally. So at the end of the day, the idea is to capitalize on what can come in as part of the process, but prepare the nation for a different future, a nation that needs, like the rest of Latin America does, is a new development model. It cannot just rely on commodities or raw materials or fully on government spending. We also have to work on institutional agendas. This means to reduce these huge levels of corruption that exist in Colombia and other Latin American countries. This is unfinished business. We have to also have a social agenda. We have to reduce inequalities. This is a shared agenda with the rest of Latin America, and I think it's the only path to ensure that peace can take root in Colombia. We can't go back to old mediocre growth in Latin America, because if you have a larger middle class, it's no longer going to be possible, as we're saying, to just look look the other way when we see major inequalities, because we don't want to move backwards in Latin America, going back to old types of populism that are currently prevailing in certain countries. So we have to be competitive. There has to be a new social contract in Colombia and the rest of Latin America, and that's the way we're going to tackle the challenges. Thank you. Thank you. It's interesting to hear the differences between Argentina and Colombia, which are relatively similar in size in terms of population. Okay, and now I wanted to talk about what's happening in Brazil with the Brazilian economy. The president's approval ratings have fallen even below 10% in some cases. This is huge. And then the country is enmeshed in the Petrobras scandal. And there is Dilma Rousseff going to be impeached, etc. So what is your vision about Brazil? Well, first, I think I'm the only one who is not going to celebrate the fact that this is in Spanish. I apologize ahead of time for my terrible Spanish, but I hope you understand me as I share what I think is going to happen. And I think you'll all understand and believe me when I say nobody knows what's going to happen in Brazil, and that's the major problem in Brazil now. It's the uncertainty. It was generated by a political and economic crisis, and it is a part of the largest corruption case ever investigated in Brazil. I don't think I have ever myself experienced a situation like this where nobody knows what's going to happen. It's even different from the situation in the 80s and 90s. Investments have been suspended, and those in the government and Congress are paralyzed because of the internal dispute of whether there will be an impeachment process against the president. The government is doing whatever it can to prevent impeachment from happening, and the opposition wants this to go forward. And both sides are focusing all of their efforts on this. And in the middle, we have the Speaker of the Chamber of Deputies, who is the most recent target of corruption, of the corruption scandal with Petrobras. Dilma Rousseff took office just 10 months ago, but it seems like an eternity. Her approval levels have tanked, and this was because of mistakes that she herself made. There are two possible paths that could be taken, and we can talk about those in more depth. But today we heard we've heard a bit more about impeachment. This was something that was raised in the Chamber of Deputies. Also, the credit rating of Standard & Poor's had lowered the rating that Brazil had achieved in 2008, and it may be that another credit agency will make a similar decision. And this is very negative in terms of the country's ability to attract investors and attract money. There's also the matter of corruption. This is involved in this is Petrobras, which is the largest state company. That Petrobras accounts for approximately 2% of GDP, and the major developers involved account for another 3%. The economy it will drop at 3%, which is much more than any economist had predicted in at the beginning of the year. And they aren't sure if recovery is possible in 2016. Unemployment and inflation are approximately 10%. This constitutes a threat to the social gains that have been made in recent years. As Ruiz was saying here, employment and jobs were one of the catalysts for the creation of this larger middle class, which is part of the economic engine of the country. It's potential that there will be primary deficits for the second year in a row. And we're at a crossroads, and the president is trying to correct the excesses of the economic policies implemented during her first term. But there's great pressure from workers and from the Minister of the Economy to adopt unorthodox economic policies, artificial reductions in interest rates and fiscal expansion in this scenario through more government spending. The future of the country depends on the path we choose at this crossroads. And the government should resist the temptation to implement populist measures and find a solution that will bring political stability to the country. One of the operations in fighting corruption has left a significant legacy. There was a change in the way in which institutions in Brazil take on this problem. For the first time in history, the country is seeing some of the most powerful members of the business community actually going to prison. There was one individual who was arrested in June, and this is something that hadn't been seen before in Brazil. The investigations should also exercise greater pressure towards economic reforms to reduce the scandalous number of parties that we have. We have 32 political parties now, and it makes governing a matter of constant negotiations and always based on certain interests. And many of the bribes that were paid in the case of Petrobras came from the political parties that they benefited from them to reach power. It's like Aesop's fables. Brazil, during the Bonanza years, implemented reforms that didn't do that during the Bonanza to make it more competitive and to attract investment in education, which, as we've heard, is the foundation for sustainable growth in Latin America. This is an agenda that will have to be taken on by anyone who reaches power. Okay, thank you, Claudia. In the case of Mexico, I wanted to ask about statements that were made by the Secretary of Economy, who's like the finance minister and the right-hand man of Enrique Peña Nieto, who is involved in a number of scandals. It has to do with the purchase of several homes, scandals that Villagaray is also involved in, also the scandal in Peña Nieto because they haven't found those 43 student teachers, the normalistas, as they're known, in Iguala, in the Ayotzinapa school. It's scandalous because, and the scandal of Chapo Guzman, who escaped from prison. But Mr. Villagaray said Mexico is a country that is well positioned to face issues. That's when he was responding to this. Is Mexico prepared?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, and thank Brookings and Ceres. I think it's paradoxical to see now how in Mexico, well, it's kind of a schizophrenic country. It has economic operators that are very effective and do well in managing finances. They learned from the crisis. This was called the tequila effect, the first large crisis of the 21st century. And then we have a very capable economist. But at the same time, we have a political class that is not up to the task. And I recall, and I'm sure you recall, the expectations that were created by Presidente Peña Nieto when he began his term. He was on Time magazine cover. But now we have ongoing crises. I recall that when he took on power, the promise of structural reforms, which were very necessary, was for all Mexicans. Well, this created great expectations. But as many times what happens with regard to political expectations is that it's a boomerang. In other words, if you cannot meet people's expectations, they come back to haunt you. And I think this is what has happened with President Peña Nieto. The significant and necessary reforms on the fiscal side and the educational side. Also, the petroleum sector is very complicated. I remember that many people were worried about the energy reform because they thought that the energy reform meant, well, are the gringos going to come and are they going to take over our oil companies? Because there's this left segment of our society that believes that the gringos are going to come and take over. So there's a process of debate, and there was discussion, there were protests in the street. I think that perhaps the debate was not intelligently done, or the reforms either. So they did come out, but not smoothly. But one thing is to foster reform and prove them through decree laws, and a different thing is the context in which you actually try to implement reform. And this was mentioned by other panelists. What is needed in Latin America, and in Mexico in particular, is the birth of the modern state. And what do we understand by this? A state where there is a rule of law, where the freedoms are guaranteed, where development and growth is inclusive, as Ernesto said. I think that is the pending issue. When we don't have this combination of factors, when the context does not support the reforms, the reforms, of course, come up against this. Well, if on top of this you add these scandals of corruption, well, the properties of the spouse of the president, built by a constructor or a builder who had actually benefited from policies, well, also the Secretary of Finance, and then Chapo Guzman's escape, Mexicans, well, think, what else is going to happen now? And so this speaks to the fact that there is an incredible lack of credibility with regard to politicians. And Mexicans do not believe in their politicians, and I think they're right to not believe in them. What we can't lose sight of is that I believe that countries like Mexico, with these phenomenon of the Facebook, Twitter, social networks, I have the impression that history has sped up. Societies are not so passive. No, now they're more demanding. And why are they more belligerent? Why are they demanding more? Because in Mexico, where the demographic equation is the reverse of what it is in Europe, in other words, we have more young people than elderly people. When these young people go to university and they come out of university, they can't find a job. And so there's social exclusion that's occurring. If on top of that you add the fact that we have more than 50 million poor people, well, we have a great social lag. And the Peña Nieto government, well, to fight crime and has made some progress, for example, with this opportunity program that was put in place. But since oil prices have declined and then these other crises that have been unleashed, the number of poor people, the figures have gone up markedly. So at first they were able to lower the percentage of poverty, but of course oil is what is supporting 40% of our public accounts. And so, of course, what has the government had to do? It has to tighten its belt in order to continue to help the poor people. And also this kind of governance where you are actually giving favors to people because they're close to you, and the state actually has agreements with on the other tacit ones with mafia types, even the educational unions. But the interesting thing is that the state has actually not done anything to fight the crisis. I mean, they need to diversify the economy. But the good news, from my point of view, is what is different in Mexico is that Mexico is in sync, or more in sync with the U.S. economy, because this, with regard to security, exports, imports, this week a MOU was signed with regard to customs that will allow customs agents of Mexico to be operating as from Laredo down, and vice versa. For example, U.S. agents can, customs agents can operate in Tijuana. And so what we're trying to do in Asia also, this is also starting to bear fruits. And I think there's no way back. But I think that the great question now is, to what extent this new model or this new agreement is going to allow for social development? Will it meet expectations with regard to social inclusiveness, taking into account that Mexico is one of the most unequal countries? We have some of the richest, or we have almost the richest man in the world, Carlos Slim, right? And then we have people who live in absolute misery. And so this is one of the most difficult things. The system has not been able to actually bridge the gap and reduce inequality. I agree with Ernesto, is that social inclusion is the pending issue. Because, and I'm not talking not only about the future of Mexico, because this is not just a problem that exists, for example, in Mexico, or if you look at Greece, for example, or it's not just Spain, it's not just Latin America. I remember that when I was a correspondent in Europe, I remember that when I would go to Spain and Germany, I would think, I would love for this kind of welfare state to exist in Mexico, but that has been eroded in Europe. And so what we have to resign ourselves to, especially new generations, is to ever more precarious work that is not well paid. And in that context, if we do not resolve the problem of social inclusiveness, I think that can be a ticking time bomb. Well, and finally, we do have Mark Basset, but I did want to add that Joe Biden, it turns out, is not going to get involved in the presidential race. Well, Spain is extremely important for Latin America, Mark. And it, of course, represented Latin America and the region in the European Union. And 40% of foreign direct investment from Spain goes to Latin America. Well, but the trade between Latin America and Spain does not reach high volumes. What can you say about this phenomenon? Well, the relationship of Spain with Latin America is based on investment, economic ties, cultural ties, and also historical ties. Well, the Spanish Empire, well, it's led to a difficult relationship sometime, but we have two pillars here which are important for Spain, the inclusion in the European Union, and of course this is a matter that's now being debated once again, but it was fundamental to Spain to anchor itself in Europe. And then we have this other link with Latin America. Latin America affords Spain a very particular identity in the European Union. It's a medium-income country. It doesn't have the economic strength of France or Germany, but it does have this idiosyncrasy that it, in a way, is the bridge between Europe and Latin America. And the fact that Spain is a member of the European Union, this strengthens ties with the European Union and also gives Spain value added in its relationship with Latin America. But, of course, in recent years, the economic crisis, which has been very serious in Spain, has led to some withdrawal. And that's been seen not, all over the world, but also in Latin America. Well, behind the Latin American or pro-Latin American talk in Spain, we don't see many times real measures taken. A specific case, which we've seen in recent months, is Cuba. For example, this has been extremely important, what has been going on in Cuba, for example, this geopolitically speaking, the improvement of the relationship between the U.S. and the Cubans. The Vatican was involved. European Union countries have run to support this. But Spain doesn't seem to have been on the front lines of this, and it's an example of how Spain has not been up to the task, really. And it's very striking that in these panels, for example, the mention of Spain, has been inexistent. Spain needs Latin America, both politically and economically. For example, also Spain's presence in Latin America is important. But after having heard the economists speak, I'm wondering, does Latin America need Spain in the time of turbulence and in times of economic crisis? After the golden decade in Latin America, is Latin America looking to Washington, to the Federal Reserve? It's looking to China. But I wonder, is it looking at Spain? And that would be my conclusion. I think Spain needs Latin America, but Latin America does not seem to need Spain. I think it's important to recall that he is from El País newspaper, which is one of the most important sponsors of this event, and they have a wonderful electronic version of the newspaper. I don't know if there are any questions in the audience. If you do, please go ahead and please be brief. It's for Paula. Paula, you said that Sunday's elections, well, the possibility of the first round or runoff, what would happen if for example, the difference in the vote for one candidate or another was almost negligible, that this difference would mean that the courts would have to get involved in the recount and that this could actually call into question the legitimacy of the new president. Yes, that's one of the possibilities of what could happen this Sunday. As you know, so someone becomes president in the first round, they must get more than 45% of the vote, or if not, more than 40% if the second person gets a certain percentage of the vote. Now, Scioli has 38% currently, with 2 percentage points more, 40%, and Macri has 29-30%. So 1 percentage more or less can actually mean that there's a winner in the first round or not. And we have some serious precedents where the election in Tucumán region some months ago, the courts got involved. There were incredible irregularities. Some of the ballot boxes were burnt. And so we see also manipulation of votes, and we see people stealing actually the voting papers, and people go to find the ballots for a certain party and they can't find them. And so there is a national movement against this because there's a great concern, and people are demanding that prosecutors go and oversee the election so that they are clean, or at least as clean as possible. It favors no one that there be a new president whose legitimacy is called into question. And Scioli, for example, who's leading the polls, and he would not be favored in that kind of situation. Now, in the Peronism, there are some things that happened in the past which might lead us to think otherwise. For example, Kirchner, when he was elected, for example, only got 20-some% and then actually was a strong president. Ernesto, I'd like to know, Claudia, I understand what you said, that it's not possible to say what's going to happen in the future, predict it. You don't have a crystal ball. But if, just if, Vilma actually decides to resign, what would happen to the political architecture in Brazil? And do you think there would be possibilities of governance, and that a government, a new government, could act decisively? Well, I need to look at the Constitution. I think that if they resign before half their term is over, I think there need to be new elections. Well, I think it depends on the context. I think it's the best path. It would be the best path for her to resign. But also, of course, we would need to also have the vice. Well, of course, the vice president would take over. There wouldn't be new elections, excuse me. But it also depends on Michel Temer can actually negotiate with the opposition. It depends also on the opposition. Many of the problems the government is having with regard to governance has to do with the division that exists within the government, PNB, and we have the Speaker of the Chamber of Deputies, who's from the PNB. So it depends on whether the PMB supports Michelle Kemmer. What is going to be the position of the PT? And they have many seats in Congress. And how the opposition acts, it's unknown. It depends on a political agreement, perhaps, or whether the pressure continues to have new elections, not just a resignation of Dilma, but also resignation of the vice president. That is a possibility. There are two paths that the opposition is trying to force on the president. One would be through the electoral tribunal, which would be to actually revoke her mandate. And so in that case, we would need the resignation of the president and the vice president, and then new elections would be called if it's before the she's finished with half the term, or also the request for impeachment. If this request for impeachment based on personal liability or responsibility of the president, and she is impeached, then the vice president would have to take over. If the vice president were involved somehow or accused, he would also probably have to resign. Well, I think our time is over. Thank you very much to Brookings and Ceres, to El País newspaper. Thank you to all of our panelists, Jose Jaime, Jose Manuel, Claudia, Mark, and Paula. I look forward to seeing you next time.